loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. In our first hour, we take a look at two big stories. First, the Trump administration, through National Security Advisor John Bolton, rolled out aggressive new moves targeting the International Criminal Court, the ICC, proposing that the United States government will impose economic sanctions on ICC judges should they dare take up the case of possible American wrongdoing or crimes against humanity. And Bolton also announced that the United States government is shutting down the official diplomatic PLO Palestinian Authority offices in Washington, D.C. And then it's Monday, which means that we have our weekly half-hour segment called Technology Rules with Chris Garofa, a weekly guide on how monopoly corporations and the national surveillance state are threatening cherished freedoms, civil rights, and civil liberties.
But before we get to those stories, we'll go over today's headlines, including five that we'll cover in depth in the second hour. First, Maria Butina, a Russian national accused by the Justice Department of conspiring to represent a foreign government without registering, had a hearing today to determine if she should be allowed bail. Prosecutors had initially accused Butina of being a Russian spy and of using sex to ingratiate herself with her targets, but they withdrew those accusations over the weekend and apologized. Next, General Joseph Dunford, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, said over the weekend that the U.S. had drawn up contingency plans in case of a Syrian chemical attack on the city of Idlib. The Western media has reported over the past few days that Syrian President Bashar al-Assad would use chemical weapons on Idlib, but the information appears to be coming from the controversial White Helmets rather than from intelligence sources. Meanwhile, the United States has been accused of using white phosphorus munitions near the eastern Syrian city of Deir Ezzor. Then, Les Moonves, the chief executive officer of CBS Incorporated, resigned last night in the wake of yet more accusations that he sexually harassed female employees at the network over a period of years. The resignation was not a surprise, as Moonves has been the subject of accusations of inappropriate behavior for more than a year now. And then Sweden has been plunged into political uncertainty after both centrist coalitions failed to win a majority in Sunday's election and a far-right anti-immigrant party with roots in the neo-Nazi movement gained ground. The two coalitions will have to work together or they will have to renege on promises to not work with the far right. And finally, today we continue our segment Education for Liberation with Bill Ayers, where Bill helps us look at the state of education across the country, what's happening in our schools, colleges, and universities, and what impact does it have on the world around us. And in other headlines, 75 Egyptians were sentenced to death over the weekend at the conclusion of a mass trial that critics are denouncing as a sham. The accused have been convicted of killing security officers during the 2013 Rabah Square protests against the removal of the Muslim Brotherhood from office. Approximately 900 protesters were killed by police during the repression of the Rabah Square demonstration. President Trump signed a decree today extending the Cuba embargo from 1962 for another year. Cuban ambassador to Russia, Gerardo Penalver Porto, announced earlier in the day that the last year of the U.S. blockade cost Cuba $4 billion. The U.N. has voted annually to condemn the U.S. blockade, and it is annually passed, often with only Israel and the U.S. voting against. In 2016, the U.S. abstained from condemning its own blockade. Florida gubernatorial candidate Republican Rick DeSantis resigned from Congress today, citing the gubernatorial race as keeping him out of Congress in the next few months. His term was already set to expire in January. George Papadopoulos was sentenced to 14 days in prison last Friday. Papadopoulos was a low-ranking foreign policy advisor to the Trump 2016 campaign. He pled guilty to lying to the FBI when questioned by investigators. Those are today's headlines. You're listening to Loud and Clear.
Loud and clear.
The following interview with Ali Abu Nima and Miko Peled was recorded at 11:15 a.m. Monday East Coast time prior to John Bolton's speech. Now we turn to U.S.-Israeli relations and the U.S. relations with the United Nations and with international agencies, including the International Criminal Court. John Bolton, U.S. National Security Advisor, will threaten the International Criminal Court, the ICC, with sanctions when he makes a speech today on the institution in Washington, D.C. According to drafts of his speech, Bolton will push for sanctions over an ICC investigation into alleged American war crimes in Afghanistan. He is also expected to announce on Monday the closure of the Palestine Liberation Organization, PLO, office in Washington because of its calls for an international criminal court inquiry into Israeli crimes against the Palestinian people. We're joined from Chicago by Ali Abunima, the co-founder of the Electronic Intifada and author of the book, The Battle for Justice in Palestine. And we're also joined from Washington, D.C. by Miko Peled, the author of The General Son, A Journey of an Israeli in Palestine. Miko Peled has a new book called Injustice, The Story of the Holy Land Foundation 5. Ali, Miko, welcome back to Loud and Clear.
Thank you.
Thank you. It's good to be with you.
Well, this is big news in some ways and potentially impactful not only for the politics of the region, but how the U.S. and the Trump administration is perceived internationally. In other ways, not so surprising, given the general trajectory of American politics in relationship to Israel as the great protector, the guarantor of Israel, and its defender against any allegations of war crimes. Sanctioning ICC judges? I don't know. Maybe it's something a little bit new. Anyway, Ali Abunima, let's start with you.
Well, it reminds me, wasn't that back in the Bush era? Of course, now we're revising the Bush era. It was a time of great prosperity and happiness and bipartisanship and respect for human rights and peace around the world. So that might be why we've forgotten the Hague Invasion Act, which was a U.S. Law basically allowing the U.S. to take military action against the International Criminal Court if it would ever put, U.S. personnel on trial. So this is a continuation of that U.S. tradition of demanding total impunity for itself and, of course, for its vassal Israel. And it indicates just the utter contempt the U.S. continues to have under Trump, as it did under Obama and under George W. Bush, for any kind of international system or constraint, the so-called rules-based order that has never in fact existed as far as the U.S. is concerned.
Ali, before we turn to Miko and get his opinion, let me just ask you, do you see anything new? I hear you 100%. The American Service Members Protection Act, the so-called...
Right, the Hague Invasion Act.
From 2002... that was designed to protect U.S. military personnel, no matter what crimes they committed. But is there something new? Is there any shift here, given the sort of falling out that or the souring of relations between the Obama administration and the Netanyahu government in Israel, where Netanyahu came to the U.S., spoke before both members of Congress, basically condemned the sitting president of the United States and his diplomatic endeavors regarding the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, and sort of was not condemned for it. Even Obama didn't condemn. Obama didn't spent more money on Israel afterwards, rewarded Netanyahu. But anyway, is there any change here, or is it just really more of the same and everything else is atmospherics?
I think it's a change in the sense that, you know, as you pointed out, under Obama, the policy was to basically implement Israel's agenda, while making some protests at the margins. Of course, there was a big disagreement over the Iran nuclear deal, but that was the only substantive disagreement. On everything else, Obama went along with Israel's agenda, particularly on the Palestinian issue, where, in fact, the way I see it, Obama was compensating Israel for defying it on the Iran issue by letting Israel run wild over the Palestinians, kind of like a spoiled child. You take away one toy, and so you compensate them by letting them, run around tearing things up. But that was Obama's approach to Israel. I think the Trump administration approach is a more honest one, which is to say that we do everything Israel wants. The Palestinian people are the enemy of the United States. We hate them. We wish for their destruction, just as Israel wishes for their destruction. We want 5 million Palestinian refugees to disappear. We want Palestinian cancer patients to die. And therefore, we're going to cut off funding to hospitals in East Jerusalem. We're going to cut off humanitarian aid to UNRWA. We're going to redefine who is a refugee. In order to have an honest implementation of our anti-Palestinian policies. That, I think, is the Trump administration's approach. It is removing, stripping away the pretense that the U.S. is anything other than an enemy to the Palestinian people. It's not the other way around. Palestinians bear no kind of natural or organic ill will to the United States, far from it. It's that the U.S. is an enemy of the Palestinian people, and that is now being reflected in Trump's policies, I think, in a more direct and honest way than any other administration has done.
Mikko Pellad, the second part of this Bolton speech is that the U.S. government is demanding the closure of the PLO mission or the PLO office here in Washington. This has been threatened a couple times in the past. Now, apparently, it's coming to pass. Is it going to make any kind of a difference in terms of U.S. policy now toward the Palestinians?
Well, it seems there's been like Ali said, there's been a ripping down of the mask of the pretense, as though America cared, as though America was in any way, shape, or form interested in some kind of a negotiated agreement, as though they cared about the tragic reality in which Palestinians live. I think it's not separate from the Jerusalem, moving the embassy to Jerusalem. It's not separate from denying or trying to destroy UNRWA and pretend that there are no refugees, that they're try to completely change the narrative of the refugee issue, change the story about the refugees. And now closing the mission, there's this collaboration, of course, between Israel and the United States on all of these issues in order to create the impression that there are no Palestinians, bring the Palestinians to a point where they are completely at the mercy of the United States and Israel, and they will agree to whatever it is that the Americans come up with this deal of the century or whatever it is that they call it. I think it's an attempt to push them to a point where they will be so desperate that they will have to agree to everything. I doubt that that's going to be the result, however. So closing the mission here is one more step in unrecognizing anything that's been recognized in regards to the Palestinians. And I think it follows quite naturally after the Jerusalem and the UNRWA decisions.
Amiko, quick follow-up. You were laughing. You were laughing when Ali Abu Nima was characterizing how now the George W. Bush era is remembered as an era where Americans upheld human rights and were good and protected democracy. You are laughing out loud, and it's really remarkable in a way. I just want to have you briefly comment on this. I mean, even now, Democrats who hated George W. Bush, I can remember being at Obama's inauguration, January 20th, 2009, 3 million people lined Pennsylvania Avenue in the mall. And when Bush got in the helicopter and was going away, 3 million people basically stuck their middle finger up in the air. It was like not only was Bush leaving, but the Bush era was ending. Now Democrats, by the majority, approve of George W. Bush. I mean, it's a remarkable shift, trajectory. And like Gore Vidal said, the United States of amnesia. Anyway, real quick, what's your take on why this has happened?
Well, I was laughing at Ali's dry humor. The way he described it, it was almost believable. People forget what he did in Iraq. I mean, people forget. I mean, I don't think it was possible to imagine anybody like him becoming president up to the point where he actually became president. And I think it relates. I think people forget the war crimes. People forget. I mean, it's the economy. I don't know what it is. How can anybody look back at the George Bush era with, you know, as though it was the good old days? I mean, it was horrifying. Perhaps, you know, for a certain segment of American society, things were good, but the rest of the world, things were terrible, and America's image in the world was worse than it had ever been. So it's impossible. And quite frankly, I think that there's a big difference between George Bush and Donald Trump. Donald Trump is not the fool that George Bush was. I don't think, you know, George Bush was held up by all these other people as more of a fool who sat in the president's chair. Donald Trump did it pretty much on his own, and I don't think he's the fool that George Bush was. He's doing everything he said he was going to do, and he's doing it to, you know, in a very brazen and clear way.
Ali Abu Nima is also our guest. Ali is with the Electronic Intifada. That was the voice of Miko Peled. Ali, again, the sort of the importance or lack of importance of actual personalities or changes in administration. We were discussing this, I have to say, in our editorial meeting this morning. The question came up, is the U.S. policy, you know, it's not a new question, is the U.S. policy in the Middle East and towards Israel and towards the Palestinians driven by a geostrategic sense where the U.S. policymakers see Israel as an extension of American power and thus provide complete and utter patronage and a blank check and funding and support for Israel, where Israel, the Israeli ruling elites, Netanyahu and the settler regime in general, have their own sort of more narrow agenda? Or is, in fact, U.S. policy now, unlike in the past, actually driven by Israel because of the closeness between the Republican Party and the Likud Party? Anyway, what's your view?
Well, these are competing forces that are always at odds. I mean, the whole U.S. political establishment is committed to the preservation and prosperity, let's say, of Israel as an apartheid state, as a racist state. But they differ on the details of how to preserve it. So the kind of liberal Obama trend sees the two-state solution as the best way to preserve Israel as a racist apartheid state for eternity. In other words, you lop off some of the Palestinians into a so-called Palestinian state, and that will guarantee Israel's Jewish majority. And on the other hand, you have the total Likudnik view, which is now dominant in the White House with David Friedman and Jared Kushner and Jason Greenblatt, who believe in a greater Israel. And so the difference is really kind of mirroring the slight difference within Israel between the Likud of Netanyahu and the right-wing coalition on the one hand, as opposed to the supposedly dovish Labour Party on the other hand. That's which believes in paper in a two-state solution, but without any real rights for Palestinians. But there is also, I think it's worth noting, a trend within the U.S. military political establishment that perceives that Israeli and American interests are not always identical. And there has always been a tension there. And we saw that most recently in the debacle over the Iran deal, where the U.S. establishment believed that detente with Iran was better for the United States' overall hegemonic and imperial interests, and was willing to stand up to Israel on that. And with the Trump administration, we see the ascendance of the wing within the U.S. Establishment that views Israeli and American interests as identical. And that may swing back again. But that is a constant sort of battle and struggle between those two wings of the pro-Israel movement in the United States.
Miko Peled, I'm wondering how the rest of the world is going to react to this over the longer term. What I mean is the United States likes to tell other countries that we're one of the very few, if not the only honest broker in the peace process. Now, Donald Trump's not going to be president forever. A Democrat is going to be president eventually, and the policy will likely change. But what will the international reaction be to that change? Will other countries continue to take us seriously if we've moved so far to one side during this administration?
Well, I think this is a test. The issue with UNRWA, the denying all the millions of dollars from UNRWA, this assault on the ICC, this brazen assault by Bolton, by the administration against the ICC, the world's got to make up their mind. Are they going to stand up to America or not? The Europeans have got to make up their mind. Are they going to stand up to America or not? I mean, today the differences between American policy and the European policy towards the Palestinians is, I would say, it's mostly cosmetic. I don't see the Europeans pressing on Israel or supporting boycott against Israel or sanctions against Israel in any serious way, not yet anyway. But this is a brazen attack, and the Europeans and the rest of the world have to decide if they're going to stand up to this bullying or not. I mean, in terms of the ICC, in terms of war crimes, I mean, you wonder. I mean, I don't know if there's a statute of limitation on war crimes, but if we talk to the United States, you know, how far back do you need to go? Or are you able to go in terms of taking the United States to the ICC? Do you go back to Hiroshima and Nagasaki? Do you go back to Vietnam? Do you go back to Iraq? I mean, how far back can you go? And at one point, if the world doesn't stand up, then America is going to continue to bully everyone. And the problem is that at the bottom of this totem pole, the people who are suffering, particularly in regards to these particular policies, are the Palestinians. I mean, they're being shot and killed and denied water and denied life and denied rights and thrown in jail and living in miserable, horrendous poverty in refugee camps at the behest of all kinds of regimes that treat them terribly. And all of this because Israel denies them the right to return, which is an absolute basic right. So is the world going to stand up, or is the world going to wait for America to change, or, you know, for some other president to sit in the White House? I think this is a very, very serious question. And the hope that I have, and I think many people have who do the kind of work that I do and the important work that Ali does, is that the call for boycott, divestment, and sanctions will reach a point where politicians can no longer ignore it, whether it's American politicians or it's European politicians, and will finally get the kind of attention and the kind of pressure that it has the potential to have on the state of Israel. And my hope is that it'll bring it to collapse. But right now, things are very severe, and the world's got to take a stance, or else things are going to get much, much worse.
That's the voice of Mikko Pellett. He's an author and journalist. We're also talking with Ali Abu Nima from the Electronic Intifada. Ali, the U.S. in the past has ignored the International Criminal Court. Nicaragua brought the U.S. to the World Court in the 1980s for mining the harbors of Nicaragua with explosives and other crimes of a military type interfering in Nicaragua. The court voted 15-0 against the United States and the U.S. at that time. I think the Reagan administration just said, well, we refuse to acknowledge the jurisdiction of the court. Now you have, though, John Bolton saying we're going to actually impose economic sanctions on the judges, like just the same tool that was used against Iraq or against Cuba or now against Russia or many, many other entities being used against International Criminal Court justices if they dare contemplate bringing the United States to justice or even hearing a case against them at The Hague. I'm just wondering, is this a precursor to the U.S. using the criminalizing of opposition to Israel or Israeli crimes, criminalizing, sanctioning BDS movements or laws passed by foreign governments? It seems to me to be moving in that direction. We have a lot of those kind of laws being entertained or have been passed in states in the United States. But what about now aggressively using the tool of economic warfare against those who engage in or support BDS globally?
This is interesting. I think it's going to force America's most loyal vassals to have to fight back, because they cannot tolerate a world in which the United States claims to be able to act as a sole dictator. I mean, they're happy for what they call U.S. leadership, but I think there's a limit when they see fundamental interests at stake. And let me give a concrete example. With the U.S. withdrawal from the Iran deal, the U.S. is now threatening total sanctions against any company that does business with Iran. And that makes it very difficult, if not impossible, for the Europeans who remain committed to the deal to continue to maintain it, because the deal requires Iran to get something, which is European investment, international investment, and so on. And if companies won't go into Iran because they fear U.S. retaliation, then that means that the Europeans cannot run their own policy. So what the German foreign minister has floated, and I think they will have to move in this direction, is moving to a payment system, an international payment system, no part of which runs through the U.S. Network or the U.S. banking system. Because the way U.S. sanctions work is that you know, if a single dollar passes through a U.S. financial network or a U.S. bank or a U.S. computer network, that's sanctionable by the United States. So now the Germans are talking about setting up a European payment system for international transactions that does not touch the United States in any way, so that they can continue to do business. And I think that's an example of how the U.S. is going to force other countries effectively to work around it. At least to me, that would be the hopeful thing, because, you know, how long can the Europeans just continue to roll over? Are they ever going to get their independence from the United States? I'd like to see them get their independence. You know, they have been effectively a colony of the United States since 1945. Now is the time to support a European independence movement. Let's see if it happens.
That's Ali Abunima. Ali is the co-founder of the Electronic Intifada, the author of the book, The Battle for Justice in Palestine. We're also joined from Washington, D.C. by Miko Peled, the author of The General Son, A Journey of an Israeli in Palestine. Miko has also authored a new book, Injustice, The Study of the Holy Land Foundation 5. Miko, we here at Sputnik have talked a lot, as we would obviously be forced to, about the question of Russian meddling in U.S. politics or the 2016 election campaign. Michael Flynn, who was the national security advisor for about 10 minutes for Donald Trump, pled guilty for lying to the FBI based on his conversations with the Russian ambassador to the United States back in, I think it was December, two different occasions in December 2016, between the time of the election of Trump and when Trump took office. But it turns out that what Michael Flynn was actually talking to the Russians about was based on a call Jared Kushner, Trump's son-in-law, talked to Flynn. Flynn called the Russian ambassador. He asked that the Russians not vote for a Security Council resolution that would have condemned Israeli settlements in the West Bank at a time when the Obama administration was signaling that it was going to abstain. In other words, and thus that resolution would pass. It would seem to me that it's the Israeli government and Michael Flynn, in this case, who was in violation of the Logan Act, which prohibits U.S. citizens from acting in the name of the U.S. while engaging with a foreign power on behalf of the latter's interest. In other words, there's kind of an Israeli gate element of meddling, which is actually never discussed. We have 1 minute left. You get the last word.
Well, it's never discussed because American politicians are spineless and gutless, and everybody's afraid to insult AIPAC and insult and get the Anti-Defamation League after them and so forth. I mean, look at what is happening in the UK right now with this witch hunt against Jeremy Corbyn. Everybody is attacking Jeremy Corbyn because of his very clear stance on Palestine, and Americans are looking and they're scared to death. And they knew, in other words, they know that this is what the Israeli lobby and its tentacles are capable of doing, and they don't want to see the same thing happen to them. I think in many ways, if we're talking about that and also about the independence of the Europeans, what happens at UK Labour at their conference coming up in a couple of weeks, and how Jeremy Corbyn comes out of this and whether or not he comes out of this on top will be a great lesson. And I think if Jeremy Corbyn does prevail and the Israeli lobby loses this battle, then hopefully it'll create some spine. It'll build some spine in American politicians as well.
All right. We're going to leave it right there. We've been joined from Chicago by Ali Abunima. Ali is the co-founder of the Electronic Intifada, author of the book, The Battle for Justice in Palestine. I encourage people to get that book. It's called The Battle for Justice in Palestine, authored by Ali Abunima. We've also been joined from Washington, D.C. by Miko Peled, the author of The General Son, A Journey of an Israeli in Palestine. And Miko has a new book, Injustice, The Story of the Holy Land Foundation 5. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay with us.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker.
And I'm John Kiriakou.
It's Monday, and that means it's our weekly half-hour segment called Technology Rules with Chris Garaffa, a weekly guide on how monopoly corporations in the national surveillance state are threatening cherished freedoms, civil rights, and civil liberties. We're joined from New Haven, Connecticut, as we are every Monday, by web developer and technologist Chris Garaffa. Chris, welcome back.
Hey, Brian and John, as always, good to be back. Happy Monday to you.
Is that a joke, the happy Monday part?
It's raining, it's cold.
It's Monday. Okay, but I agree with you. I am happy, and John looks really happy. So, Chris Garaffa, there's a number of really important big stories. Tell us where you want to start.
So I want to start with an article from the Wall Street Journal about Google. The title is Google Case Asks, Can Europe Export Privacy Rules Worldwide? So in the EU, people have been fighting and they have won this amazing right called the right to be forgotten. And it extends all across the EU. Now, what that means is that you can ask a search engine to forget about a result that you appear in, and they have to comply with that. Of course, the internet is not just in the EU, right? The internet is a worldwide tool, and you can get to it from any companies, any country. So what Google is going to appeal is this ruling that says that no matter where the data is hosted, if it's in the US or anywhere else in the world, and no matter where the person is searching from, that the right to be forgotten actually has to be respected across the world. Now, this makes complete sense, right? Because if I say I search for somebody in France, but then I go to the US and I search, the results shouldn't be different, right? And it gets more complicated because you can actually spoof and fake where you're searching from, you know, where it looks like you're getting online from. So I could be sitting in the UK or in France or Belgium and pretend to be from, easily pretend to be from the US or Canada and get those, get the results that the right to be forgotten should have blocked. Now, Google doesn't like this for a number of reasons. One, Google doesn't want to have to block these things worldwide. It doesn't believe that it should be subject to any EU regulations while in the US. And second, it's going to set a precedent that the EU rules, which are much stronger than any data privacy or protection rules in the US, could start applying to people in the US. And that is something that is very scary to Google as a company.
Chris, as sort of an addition to this, the UK has a very unusual law that allows anybody to sue for defamation in a UK court if whatever information that defamed you was available in the UK. How does this fit into the EU's privacy laws or privacy rules? Is there going to have to be a change, or are we going to end up getting to a point where we're all just suing each other when there's something about us on the internet that we don't like?
So there are in the UK for that law some, you know, strict requirements about what can and can't be considered that defamation or be required to be removed. However, you know, the question here is really what global laws are going to govern the internet effectively, because again, the internet is not just a tool in the EU. It's not just available in the US. It is a global presence. And again, the EU has much stronger data protection laws and much stronger rights to privacy than the US does. And I think we in the US need to be really looking at some of these protection laws that they have and modeling them for our own country. And since so many of these companies, Google and Facebook and all of them are based in the US, it can actually have a significant impact, not just here in the United States, but across the world, based on how they need to respond to these regulations.
Yeah, let's go to another story. Where do you want to go next, Chris?
I want to go to this one from TechCrunch. Dozens of popular iPhone apps are caught sending user location data to monetization firms. So what this means is that there were a number of popular applications. One was a weather app. Another was an app that lets you find a home, essentially like a Zillow type thing. It was called homes.com. But what they were doing was they were collecting your information, which makes sense, right? If you're using a weather app, or you're looking for homes, you want to know what the weather is nearby or what homes are available. But they were using that information not just to provide data to their own service, but they were sending it to companies like AppMetrics and Sense360, which are data warehouse companies. And these are the companies that, like Google, collect all of this information for you or on you for these companies. And they store all of that information in little archives. And they can use that amongst many, many hundreds of other signals to create kind of a profile of you, and then immediately use that information to serve you ads or do other sorts of tracking and analysis on your work online, whatever it is you're doing online. No one was aware that these apps that had other uses and claimed to be for other uses were actually sending this data to these data monetization companies. And they were never explicitly, it was never explicitly stated that that was happening.
Chris, my initial reaction to that would be, oh my gosh, my privacy is being violated. And then when I think about it, do I really care if they know where I happen to be located when I'm using the app, or how many seconds or minutes I remain on the app or using the app? Why should I be worried about this kind of technology?
So there's a number of reasons, right? So again, they're collecting all of this information to be able to profile you, and then to have, you know, to figure out what ads to serve you best. So if they know that you're in, let's say you're in New Haven and you've checked the weather there, they can maybe send you some ads that are local to New Haven, right? Which doesn't seem like the worst thing. You maybe want to get some pizza. We've got, you know, the best pizza in the world out here, and they're going to send you an ad for New Haven pizza. But in aggregate, when that information is all collected together, it can give these private companies that we have no control over such a huge idea of who we are, what we're searching for, what banking we're doing, if we have medical conditions. And there's very few regulations on how these things need to be stored and how this information is protected. And so if that gets out, which it certainly has in the past, we've talked about many of the situations where companies have been hacked and people's information has been put out into the public. If it's hacked, if it's leaked, if it's released, we have no information on where that came from or what that is. And so it's not that one you're just looking for what the weather in New Haven. It's the aggregate of everything that creates this profile of you.
And then do they monetize that information?
They do. They sell it to other companies in either as raw data, or they sell it as advertising.
Advertising.
Information. Mm-hmm. That's right. And the way these ads work is that when you go to a website that serves an ad, there's a very strong chance that within milliseconds, they have decided who you are and what ad to serve you. That's why, you know, when you search for something, then you're going to see an ad for that product for weeks or months or things in that category, but not just in that category, for things that people who wanted to buy something like you searched for might also want to buy. Right. So if you search for a vacuum cleaner, you might get other household cleaning products or services because you searched for vacuum cleaners, and they can be targeted directly to your location. And that back and forth, all of that happens within milliseconds, actually, between these data companies and the ad network that the website you're on is using.
I'm looking at an article that was in the Huffington Post. Facebook and Google's surveillance capitalism model is in trouble, and the subhead is regulators start to pump the brakes on big tech's advertising dystopia. Dystopia for our audience is the opposite of utopia. Dystopia is a dark, complicated, dangerous, hideous sort of creation, a dystopian society. But it is a new era of capitalism. I mean, working people always, you know, by virtue of their labor, created products, and those products were sold on the market. The people who owned the factories and thus owned the products, they got the profits. Workers, in exchange for their labor, got wages. And part of the modern day capitalism was to try to convince people to buy things that they might not otherwise known that they actually needed, meaning that they didn't need. And that was the function of advertising. And advertising today, I think, is the third largest sector of the U.S. economy, which, as we all know, is a capitalist economy. But what this article is describing is perhaps a new stage called surveillance capitalism, meaning the harvesting of data about individual human beings, not simply sort of general advertising or using us through the use of our labor, employing our labor in exchange for wages. Now we have a situation where the human beings actually are the commodity because the tech companies are selling the data about us to other capitalist corporations so that those corporations can fine-tune their own appeals to convince us to buy things that we might otherwise not know that we need. Is it a new stage?
I do believe it is a new stage, or the foundation for a new stage. I'm familiar actually with that article that you mentioned, and everything that it mentions about why that surveillance capitalism model is in trouble is actually based out of the EU. But you're absolutely right. We used to say that if the product is free, then actually you are the product. But now it's the case that even for things we pay for, we are still the products. We're effectively paying for the right to have our data used and used to make many, many more millions of dollars. So instead of it being our physical or mental labor, it's just our data. When you're watching Netflix, you have to pay for Netflix, but they track what you watch. They track where you rewind, actually, to figure out what shows they want to make, and then they use those shows to sell more new subscriptions. In the EU, all of the stuff coming out of the EU, they have something called the GDPR. It's the General Data Protection Regulations. And that's part of what we were talking about earlier with this Google case that's going to go up in the EU and France tomorrow. And there are a number of really great regulations in there that, of course, Facebook and Google and all of the tech giants were fighting because they aim to protect our rights to not have our data used like this. We need something like that in the United States, without a doubt.
John, you know, the other thing that must occur to anyone who's thinking objectively, who's trying to maintain an objective faculty, is that Google knows everything about you. It knows everything about me. It knows everything about Chris. I mean, everything. It knows what we did yesterday, what we looked for yesterday. Amazon, too. If I order something, I start, and I'm part of the Amazon system, I'll start to get ads for like-minded products. They know everything. And yet we know almost nothing about them.
It's true. Even though they're publicly traded companies.
Yeah, we know. I mean, we don't know how they base their algorithm. There's no transparency. Facebook and Google and Twitter are now deciding what we can see or what we can't. They're deciding through the exercise of basically a censoring impact, a censoring sort of strategy, and partnering with organizations like Atlantic Council, which are presented as civil society, when in fact, the Atlantic Council, which is a neocon think tank here in Washington, is funded by NATO and the war contractors and, you know, the biggest corporations in America, and including state actors. They're deciding what we can see. We don't know why they're deciding. In other words, we don't know actually anything about them, but they know everything about us.
And they make money off of that.
And they make money off of it. And one of the problems is that because, you know, access to the internet, which the UN now rightly defines as a core human right, because in this stage of society, our ability to access information, to communicate with people vis-a-vis the internet is fundamental to what it means to be a human being right now. I mean, it wasn't fundamental 100 years ago or even 30 years ago, but it is now. So we need to use these platforms, but because of the way the surveillance capitalism exists, they know everything about us and we know nothing about how they work, how they operate, and what their motives are. So this power imbalance, which again, isn't really very well talked about, seems to me to be kind of a fundamental element of the, you know, a core concept of democracy. Does it exist or is it a fantasy?
And there's no move on Capitol Hill to rectify this in any way. We're not hearing about bills that are being sponsored. We're not hearing about regulations that are about to be imposed to open this up to transparency, to the light. It's as though it's been foisted upon us and we have to accept it and learn to live with it.
Yeah, and Chris Garafa, when the EU tries to impose basically a minimal protection so that we, the people, in as individuals could say, look, we have the right to be left alone. We want to access internet platforms because, as the UN said, it's a human right. It's part of what it means to be alive right now. It's really what it means to be human in many ways. But we want to be able to do it because it is part of human existence. but we also don't want the surveillance capitalist corporations to be able to retain all the data. In other words, we want control. So just having this minimal safeguard is considered by Google and by the other tech companies too, to be a fundamental assault on their basic core model, which is designed to maximize profits for investors. Go ahead.
Brian, you're absolutely right. And I think what we need to also look at in this context is in the surveillance capitalism model is not just the surveillance part of it, but the capitalism part of it. And we know capitalism can't function as it exists today without a state to maintain the rights of those businesses to continue to make profit. And so the state really benefits also from this surveillance model, because whether or not Google is selling information to advertisers and all of that, it still is partnering with the state, with the agencies of the state, the NSA, CIA, FBI, with local law enforcement to provide information on demand effectively. I know you talked last week about a partnership that Apple is going to have with police. This is all of the tech companies, right? So they are working with the state, and the state also works with these companies to make sure that they are able to maximize their profits. And it's really a symbiotic relationship in that sense. And that's where the surveillance is also significantly impacting us, that very few people are talking about, in the sense that we need to be aware of not just what private companies, but what shady business is going on with state actors and state agencies to monitor us as well. There was an interesting article also in the Wall Street Journal about algorithms, right? And it's talking about actually in the UK, in London, there's a huge festival called the Notting Hill Carnival. It's called Europe's largest street party, and it's about Black British culture. So what the police did, the Metropolitan Police, is they drove around in vans with closed circuit TVs looking to catch potentially dangerous criminals, is the way they said it, and also to prevent future crimes, which is, a very Orwellian language to use. Now, of course, there's a racial aspect to this, too. It's absolute racism to go do this at the celebration of Black British culture. The problem was they found only 96 people flagged by the algorithm, and there was only one match. There were millions of people at this. But this is the kind of surveillance technology that private companies develop and then sell to the government in order to continue tracking us.
Yeah, this reminds me very much of Stinger technology, where police cars have these devices mounted on them now, usually on the trunk, and they're taking photographs of every license plate that they come into contact with, just as a car drives past you or you drive past a car, whatever it is. And they're looking for stolen cars, stolen plates, outstanding warrants, whatever. Well, they make mistakes. The algorithm makes mistakes. And so here you are, a perfectly innocent person driving down the street, and you may be wrapped up in this police operation for no good reason at all. It just seems to me that in cases like this, in a case like Chris just talked about in Notting Hill, the technology is out of control, that this is a violation of our civil liberties, and it's as though there's nobody willing to stand up to protect them.
Yeah, and I'm glad you mentioned it like that, because people, in the way this is sold is like, hey, this is the new era. This mm-hmm. is the technology of today.
You have to accept it.
You have to accept it as if the technology is the driver, as opposed to human beings making policy, making decisions. Because technology ultimately is neutral, right?
That's right.
I mean,
it only matters how we use the technology.
Yeah, absolutely. And so if only a certain part of society has the authority to make decisions about how to use the technology, the rest of us don't even know about it, and they can use it for their own purposes. And of course, when they say they're employing it against the population, which they, as you talk about in Notting Hill, it's always for a good reason. It's always to keep people safe. But in fact, if you have this kind of dragnet mass surveillance, bulk surveillance collection, and then the police can kind of, out of the data collected, not based on having probable cause mm-hmm. of a crime that's been committed.
That's right.
You just survey the entire population. You look for everyone, and then you find some matches or you find some wrongdoing at some point, and then you can link it together. You can construct a prosecution out of it. It turns everything upside down. I mean, the whole, like in America, I don't know about the UK, but the Fourth Amendment, the right to be free from a search and seizure by the government. These are the big issues. And just to go back to, for our audience who might be listening to today's show and didn't hear the show last week about Apple and the police letter, what we are talking about is that Apple is creating a special portal for law enforcement officials to legally request and receive user data from Apple, according to a letter sent to a Democratic senator in the U.S. Senate, White House. And the letter was obtained by the media outlet Business Insider. Apple, Chris, has responded to over 14,000 police requests, including 231 domestic emergency requests just in 2017. I mean, we're not talking about like once in a while in the event of a super duper national emergency. We're talking about 14,000 letters over 365 days. Go ahead.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, Apple is not out of the ordinary with that, too. Facebook, Google, Twitter, all of them do that. Everyone thinks about Apple taking on the FBI in the case of the San Bernardino shooter, where it was demanded that Apple unlock the phone. And Apple did ultimately refuse to do so. So the FBI found other ways around it. But all of the tech companies, Apple included, work with law enforcement in this sense, in emergencies, in court cases, all of that, and they have the ability to do so. Brian and John, I want to talk about another very related topic. For anyone familiar with New York City, if you've been there, you might have seen they've repurposed the old phone booths to be kiosks.
Right.
Right? They're called Link NYC. And we talked about this a few months ago, basically what these are. These are kiosks that have, it's a municipal wireless network, so you can connect to it anywhere. They have tablets in them, so you can get searches, you can get directions somewhere. They've got, you know, charging stations and stuff like that, right? Except a group called Rethink Link NYC, which is an anti-surveillance group in the city, as well as a coalition of Stop Link NYC, have identified that there is some code in these kiosks that actually could be tracking your location based on where you connect to which ones you connect to and what you're searching for. And that can be used by police. This is a private public partnership between the city and a coalition of companies. Now, Link NYC says that this code shouldn't have ever been in there. It's not in use, but they never say that it was never in use or that it's not going to be used. Now, these kiosks don't just have Wi-Fi. They have cameras on them. They have displays to target advertisements based on the user of the kiosk. And they have Bluetooth sensors so that they could potentially connect to your device just as you're walking by. You don't even have to be using this. Again, Link NYC says none of this is being used, but that code was written for a reason, even if they're just looking into it. They're really making you the product. So that's not just about data being sold to companies, but again, it's a private-public partnership, and it's going to be very easy for the NYPD or others to get access to that information. And there are over 1,500 of these kiosks, mostly centered in Midtown Manhattan. So that's where many tourists go, but they exist in every borough, all five boroughs in Manhattan. So I'd encourage folks to follow the work of the Rethink Link NYC group as they struggle against these. And for folks that are in New York or visit New York, be very aware of what these kiosks are doing.
Chris, I have kind of a related question. I saw in the news over the weekend that in California during these great fires that the state has seen over the past few weeks, that the internet providing companies in Northern California actually slowed service down, and it affected firefighters who were trying to fight these fires, with the lesson being, welcome to the end of net neutrality. Now, California has passed a net neutrality law. How strong is this net neutrality law? Is it going to stop or put an end to situations like we just saw with these fires where private companies are capitalizing on these natural disasters and making money by slowing down the internet? And do you think that this new California law might be a model for the rest of the country?
Chris, also, when you're answering that, why did they do?
Yeah, why? Why do something like that? Potentially putting lives in danger.
Well, Verizon and AT&T need to make money. They exist to make a profit. And I think, you know, many people are aware that these new unlimited plans, they've got a really bizarre definition of unlimited, because if you hit a certain amount of data, then they slow down your data connection. And that's exactly what happened in California. It's outrageous that they were doing that. There were so many firefighters fighting these giant fires, and they need to be able to communicate with each other, with central dispatches, just to stay, you know, on top of these fires. So California did recently, towards the end of the month, pass what's called SB 822. It first passed the Assembly and then passed the Senate. And now it's basically the ISP spent millions of dollars against this, which says a lot about how good this bill is. I'm a big fan of this. Effectively, it goes back to the 2015 open internet order that the FCC put into place nationally, and effectively puts into place a lot of the provisions for California and ISPs that work and exist in California, that sell their services in California. There were many, many millions of dollars. There were lobbying, spent on, you know, astroturfing promotions against this. But it has passed, and it's fantastic. And I think we need to be looking at a lot of the provisions of this bill as we learn more about how it's going to be put into effect. But yes, it would have prevented that situation for the firefighters.
We've got about 2.5 minutes left. And, you know, we like to close this segment with something that consumers can use, your tech tip of the week. This week, you wanted to talk about VPN. What is VPN and when do we need to use it?
Sure. So a VPN, it's called a virtual private network. And effectively, it's a way to secure the information that you're sending over the internet from people who might be tracking your local network. So I always, if I'm going out to a coffee shop to get some work done, or I'm at somebody's home and I don't trust their Wi-Fi network because there's no password on it, I immediately turn on my VPN, whether it's on my phone or my computer, so that all of the information that I'm sending out, my bank password, my Facebook info, isn't just sent out in plain text over the air, because it's possible for anyone sitting on an open Wi-Fi network to see what you're sending over the air.
You know, that happened to me too. If I can interrupt you for 1 second, when I upgraded my phone, I went to the Sprint store. I got the next, whatever the next upgrade was, the iPhone 7, I guess it was at the time. And I wanted to open Facebook. And so I did it in the store. I plugged in my password, and almost instantly I got hacked. And it seemed like everybody had my Facebook password, and someone was sending all kinds of messages out asking for money to be wired and all kinds of terrible stuff.
I think it was the Russians.
Of course, the Russians, right?
Well, using a VPN helps to protect. It's not foolproof, but it certainly helps to protect your information that way. I highly recommend using a paid VPN service, because if you're not paying for it, you are the product. So I use a service called Private Internet Access. It's a few dollars a month. There's also one called Nord, N-O-R-D VPN, which is based out of, I believe, Scandinavia, and that has great data protection. You want to find one that's not going to keep logs about what you're doing, which is why I like Private Internet Access, and there are a number of others. And you pay for their service, and they give you some settings to put in on your phone or computer, and then whenever you're on a Wi-Fi network you don't trust, which honestly should be most of them if you haven't set them up yourself, then you just turn it on and help to protect your data.
All right, we're going to leave it right there. That was Chris Garofa. We were talking to him from New Haven, as we do every Monday in this segment called Technology Rules with Chris Garofa, a weekly guide on how monopoly corporations and the national surveillance state are threatening cherished freedom, civil rights, and civil liberties. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay with us.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.